On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With televangelist Jerry Falwell's death this week, the story of his moral majority crusade has been very much in the news again. My guest today, British historian Ben Wilson, has been looking at the moral majority movement of another era, from the licentious, libertine, anything-goes Britain of the wild 18th century to the mother of all buttoned-up moral majority moments, the Victorian age. It's quite a story of sex and virtue, liberty and law, a real showdown over what makes the truly good and free life. Up next on Point, the moral majority of yesteryear and how Britain went Victorian. Joining me now from London is historian Ben Wilson. His remarkable new history is The Making of Victorian Values, Decency, and Dissent in Britain, 1789 to 1837. Ben Wilson, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
It's great to have you, and what a remarkable story. All kinds of wild and woolly life before the 18th century ended, and then what you're really writing about here is the run-up to Victoria and the Victorian era, its birth. In effect, your preface calls it moral rearmament right off the bat.
Right.
It echoes so loudly in our American ears today. I wish you'd take us back just to begin with and help us understand the setting. It won't be familiar to everyone. You describe an 18th century with a kind of libertine spirit inspired by Byron and Shelley and the Romantics. Before we get to the Victorians, we have a kind of sense of what they brought to bear. But what was this age that preceded it? And what was it that so upset the Victorians once they came on the scene and surveyed it?
Well, it's a fantastic period and one I've always been interested in. You can't not look at this period and see a huge shift in values that happens very quickly from an age where people are allowed to indulge their passions and a certain amount of vice is tolerated as the price that the country has to pay for liberty. But through this period, with the background of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars and terrible kind of natural disasters like harvest failures, there's a growing anxiety and a growing intolerance of nuisances and other people's vices, that this is what's holding the country back. At a time when Britain's, on one hand, is taking off, and on the other hand, is sort of facing lots of short-term disasters, and larger ones like the threat of Napoleon that hangs over a generation. Mm. And by the time that generation reaches maturity, in about the 1820s, there's a much greater intolerance of vice and a desire to clean up the country, and a desire that not only that the country has a moral aspect, but individuals do as well.
We don't want to draw the parallels too tightly, and yet we can't help hear them. I'm reading in The Guardian, which called your book a tour de force, but they say this is the history of an era rather like our own, a time when dissenters and rebels were hemmed in by conformists and hard-headed authoritarians, a time when a nation on the eve of global domination fretted about its future, hello, USA, a period on the eve, I don't know, but maybe, a period when those who argued that a British empire would be a disaster for liberty were eventually squashed by imperialists. Do you see a sharp parallel between this transition time and the world today, the USA today? Is it the subtext for this?
I think so. I mean, it was impossible researching it and writing it not to see a certain amount of parallels, not least the kind of the anxiety that dogged people in the beginning of the 19th century. That they lived under time of progress, but also of fear. That a lot of people saw Napoleon as a sort of antichrist figure who had the capacity to destroy Britain, which was becoming a great imperial power. So I think it's that kind of the anxiety of a country that's sort of reaching the apogee of its powers. And also sort of feeling they have to take account of it to justify themselves to the world as individuals and as a nation. And I think there's definite parallels, I think, with a growing intolerance, certainly over in Britain. There's a much greater intolerance of disorder and antisocial behaviour. All those kind of things were definitely in the back of my mind, or in front of my mind, actually, when I was writing it.
So then you had this generation of evangelicals and philosophical utilitarians, political economists. They saw, the New York Sun says, in pre-Victorian England, Britain, disorder, lasciviousness, mendacity, vagrancy, inefficiencies, lack of personal discipline permeating the lives of the poor and working classes in particular, and in on that come vice suppressors and makers of manners.
I really wish you would paint the picture of that pre-Victorian age for us. We were busy on this side of the pond with something very different. You quote Thomas Jefferson right at the beginning of your preface saying, "It is the manners and spirit of a people which preserve a republican vigor. A degeneracy in these is a canker which soon eats to the heart of its laws and constitution." That, at least in our national memory, is the project we were about at the end of the 18th century. Mm. But you had something fairly different going on in England at that time. What was that world of Byron and Shelley and the Romantics and that libertine life like?
The libertine life, well, there was, for all social classes, there was a certain amount of drunkenness was tolerated and bad language and public displays of all kinds of antisocial behaviour and no police force that really dealt with it in a systematic manner. It was left to local communities. And at the same time, there was that view of Jefferson was echoed very strongly in Britain, with lots of private societies being founded to reform all layers of society, from the lower classes who drank and swore and were ill-disciplined and wouldn't go to work if they didn't feel like it, wouldn't go to work unless they were fed on a constant stream of ale or gin. So there was an insubordination, which is coinciding at a time of industrialisation and the fragmentation of old solidarities and corporate elements in society, and the evangelicals saw that the best way to start with society was at the top, to try and reform the aristocracy and to stamp out that kind of libertinism that was sort of flourishing amongst not just young men out on the out to get drunk and make merry, but with their older people as well, who weren't very used to hiding their vices, which was seen as deeply hypocritical, to try and conceal something that was inside that was maybe bad. It was, you know, it was best to be honest. And there's no contradiction. I think the Victorians...
Honest about human nature, honest about the desires.
Yeah, about indulging, indulging the passions, things like that. It was seen as the mark of an evil person to try and contain these things.
You say passions were something to be celebrated rather than suppressed. Baudiness was permitted without its degenerating into anything like Victorian pornography. Hypocrisy was dreaded. Candor in judging others, a virtue. That kind of, in a nutshell, the spirit of that age.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, I mean, that contrasts so much with the Victorians, or even right in the era just before Victoria, as his vice is being stamped out, it's considered more manly to conceal your bad passions, whereas before it was seen as the act of a dissembler and someone who was a liar to himself as well as to society. But in the 1820s, people start saying, "What's so wrong with hypocrisy if it makes you polite and a good member of society?"
So what? Give us some examples of the kinds of activities, social, personal, and otherwise, that were widespread in the 18th century that by the 1820s people were really putting the squeeze on. What kind of life was getting pushed away, pushed out, or what kind of attitudes, outlook?
Well, it's different for different levels of society. I think in the middle classes, especially in the 18th century, tradesmen and shopkeepers and the very well-to-do of London would go to drinking clubs and while their evenings away over the bottle, and probably worse things as well. This was considered quite normal. And
don't be shy. What do you mean, worse things? Prostitution?
Prostitution, sort of minor crime, antisocial behaviour. Prostitution was very big and very open, much more open than it was in Victorian times.
Mm-hmm.
Probably more common in Victorian times, but better concealed.
So there's the middle class kind of train. What about upper, lower?
The upper classes were especially male upper classes. It was considered a rite of passage to sleep with as many women as possible, to drink, to sort of make merry in the streets and break windows. Even their fathers would while away their times at clubs, drinking and having lots of mistresses. Upper class women had quite a free spirit as well. But I think in this sort of changing sensibility, it marks the upper class first, because they become very anxious by the French Revolution.
Afraid that Napoleon might sweep across. Of course, there was Waterloo.
Even before the rise of Napoleon, it was the execution of aristocrats in France, and shockwaves over the British aristocracy. And they said the first action of the French Revolution was to send the upper classes scurrying back to church, where they'd
We need some order here. We need some authority here. That sort of
stuff. Yeah, well, they needed to justify themselves to other groups in society that they could be philanthropic, that they could lead society. And one of the kind of the leading figures in that was William Wilberforce, who is best remembered for ending the trade in slaves.
Yes.
Saw his second most important role was reforming the manners of the upper classes, really so that they could survive into the 19th century by showing a kind of moral complexion to society.
And for the poor, was their life so different before and after the sort of Victorian
Hugely
Revolution?
Different. I think the very sort of nature of labour was different. People had much more freedom at work, had freedom in their leisure times. There was an institution called Saint Monday, which was workers would refuse to go to work on Monday because they were paid by the amount of work they did rather than the time they spent at work. And so they would literally refuse to go to work on Mondays, and they'd spend their days drinking gin or indulging in cruel sports or whatever they felt like doing.
Just to get a kind of sound of what would come in our ears, so remember, Queen Victoria, the UK's longest reigning monarch, 1837 to 1901, marked by the very thing that defines Victorian in our minds today: prudishness, moral uprightness, also scandal. 1997 movie Mrs. Brown, there was a portrayal of the passionate friendship between Queen Victoria and her Scots manservant, Mr. Brown. In this scene, the Queen, played by Dame Judi Dench, and Mr. Brown, played by Billy Connolly, returned to her castle from an outing several hours late. Castle staff nearly apoplectic with worry and disapproval.
Your Majesty, thank goodness you're safe. I'll have a bath prepared immediately. I recommend McDonald's African embrocation.
Ah, pipe, don't mind the woman's fine.
We stayed a little longer than expected with Mr. and Mrs. Grant. It was most agreeable.
We were expecting you to return by 6.
And now I'm back.
And we had a wee nip of whiskey.
To keep out the cold.
Aye.
Thank you, John.
She's drunk. Distinct flushing around the cheeks. She was drunk, I tell you.
No, she wasn't.
Surely not.
Don't even think it.
And then there from the movie, Queen Victoria herself flouting Victorian values. Ben Wilson, describe for us, there was by this time she's there and Victorian values are well ensconced historically. But on the way to that, you describe this incredible tension. It was a real battle over whose view of freedom and liberty and virtue was going to prevail.
Yeah, there's a sense that British values were under attack by the people that would reform them, the robustness of British life, kind of the honesty, the plain talking was being ironed out, and it was becoming harder to speak frankly, to say things that had been said before, that somehow, whether by social disciplines or by actual coercive police actions, people were too afraid to express themselves or to act in ways that they didn't, and that as the country became more industrialized, as Britain became an imperial power, that the price to pay was something that was implicit in the national character and what it was to be British.
Lord Byron, among others, pushed back. He was very unhappy with what evolved here. Describe his resistance for us.
Well, Byron was the first to sort of suffer from this kind of thing, and people like to make an example of him, partly because he was so famous, and he raised the ire of the public twice, once when he left his wife in the 1815 and went to and fled the angry British public and went to Italy. And then again when he published Don Juan, his greatest work, which was spoken very frank language, but language that he considered to be in the line of Chaucer and Shakespeare and Alexander Pope. He hadn't done anything wrong, but the moral outrage from the people was from the press and from members of the public was quite extraordinary. People said that in public, people would never say they'd read Don Juan, but someone must have done because it was an extraordinary bestseller.
Or Don Juan, as we say. Yeah.
Yes. It uses frank language, but it's not. It's not too licentious by standards, but it caused a furore, which completely shocked Byron, And he saw this as a barometer of the way that the British were changing. It was the first real incidence of a kind of a moral disapproval on a vast scale. But it was seen as being hypocritical because people had enjoyed Byron before. It was only when he was in exile and had lost faith with the British public that they turned against him.
He saw it as a turning away from honesty.
Yeah, that kind of frank language, that was certainly how Byron saw it and how his supporters saw it. It was seen as marking a turning point in British manners and in British, what people were prepared to accept in public. And they needed someone like Lord Byron to bring down a peg or two in order to express their own morality.
But they, of course, had a very different view. You quote the Victorian moralist James Fitzjames Stephen saying, "Complete moral tolerance is possible only when men have become completely indifferent to each other, that is to say, when society is at an end." There's this sort of pugnacious moralist saying, we're not going to tolerate everything, thank you very much.
Yes, quite. It was people saw it as you have to shout loud in order to get your voice across, and this was one incident. But there was plenty of other salacious materials in society, the things that were much worse. If you go for something that's not extraordinarily bad, then it's setting the bar very high. It's deliberately taking a moral high ground that's almost impossible to live up to in sort of ordinary circumstances.
So we've watched in this country the moral majority pull in millions of members and exert its influence on the American political conversation, cultural conversations, values conversations, certainly. How did it work in the 19th century in the UK as Victorian values or virtues began to circulate and be embraced? How were they propagated? How did it actually work?
The press, especially the press that was seen as representing the middle classes, liked to take examples of people like Byron. They took examples of other people, like famous actors who deviated from the moral code. So that's one instance. There's a greater publicity for people in the public eye, and it scares the aristocracy away from displaying their vices in public, washing their dirty linen in public. On a lower scale, there's the societies that are founded by people like William Wilberforce and other upper-class members or people that come from the dissenting communities, from the evangelicals, who try and mobilise middle-class public opinion to suppress vices like pornography in public and trading on a Sunday. In the beginning of this period, they're treated as something of a joke, and some members are deeply corrupt and get into trouble. But as the period goes on, they gain a credibility and gain members from the aristocracy and sometimes the royal family, which sort of publicises their case, which some of these things pass into law after sort of sustained public campaigns. So it comes at first from a small minority of genuinely motivated evangelicals and people who want to reform society for other reasons, maybe economic. And this builds up over time, and depending on the anxieties that are affecting the country, their voice becomes louder and louder and becomes impossible for people to resist.
So you go from the sort of wild rumpus era to, by the 1820s, British people have a sense of truly living in a changed world.
People see the changes. They remark on them, and they remark on how quickly they're happening. That something of the spontaneity of the British character is going. People say in the past people dressed as they liked, but by the 1820s everyone's wearing the same clothes. It's impossible to tell people apart. The kind of eccentric, rough and tumble of life is going, and people remark on it. And things like clothing are an indicator of changes more generally.
And the press, which, of course, now you've got the printing press and widespread newspapers and all that, very effective at spreading the new outlook on life.
Absolutely. And they're so successful, I think, because the press is a mass press is a very new thing. More and more people are reading the same things. So it's easier to broadcast this message. And there's a the economic ideas about sort of self-reliance, discipline, self-discipline, self-restraint sort of play into these ideas that are being propagated by evangelicals. So this message is coming at people from all sides, like never before, and because of the technology, change technologies of transport and printing, it reaches people, and people follow the fashions in morals as well as everything else.
Ultimately, the British, as you described them, came to see the Victorian age as a time of tremendous hypocrisy in addition to the button-down side. But you quote, I mean, Francis Place was a tailor in Charing Cross, had been grown up in poverty and sort of the debauchery that was common in that class and time. But ultimately saying that English had become a much better people now. This is during the Victorian age, a much better people now than we were then. Better instructed, more sincere and kind-hearted, less gross and brutal, and have come to, you're quoting, have few of the concomitant vices of a less civilized age.
Yeah, Francis Place is a fascinating character. He grows up in this kind of world of fairly prosperous middle-class people. But he's not prosperous, but he hangs out with them. And he sees that they're the next generation is sort of outgrowing their vices and their drunkenness. And it's mirrored in the progress of Britain is a civilizing force. And people are very proud of what they've achieved. A lot of people resist it, but a lot more see that Britain has defeated Napoleon. It's defeated its own bad habits. It's sort of conquered nature. Human nature as well as sort of physical nature, and so it's something to be celebrated that the kind of the barbarousness of life has been ironed out against sort of all the odds.
We'll look more at how the British see that today. But you quote some very admiring Americans, including Newt Gingrich, in 1995, saying Victorian England changed the whole momentum of their society. They didn't do it through bureaucracy. They did it by reestablishing values, by moral leadership, by being willing to look at people in the face and say, you should be ashamed when you get drunk in public. You should be ashamed if you're a drug addict. I think moral force matters. There's Newt Gingrich lauding the Victorian age produced in just this period.
Yeah, it is a remarkable achievement. For good or ill, it's quite a unique thing in history, I think, is to have such a self-assured and self-confident and morally cohesive country. Whether that benefited everyone, whether something was lost, as lots of people felt, something was lost in this rush of progress, that people in the Victorian age had become more concerned about the poor, they'd enrich themselves. The country was kind of humming with prosperity and looked better. The cities were cleaner. The new buildings had risen above it. But in this sort of rush of progress and rush of improvement of all kinds, something of the kind of the creativity of British people had been lost to a more conformist time, and that lower down the social scale, the people that had lost were the lower classes who found this kind of new world of individualism and laissez-faire, where people were left to stand on their own two feet and to exert their own sort of their own moral responsibility and their own sort of economic self-reliance. That they were the people that were losing out, and it took another kind of morality that appears towards the end of the century to raise them up to the same sort of standards of education and moral respectability. That second wave took something else. It wasn't quite that kind of early, the thing I describe in the book, and the thing that, I don't know, the high point of Victorianism is a very self-reliant moral place, but there were losers in that situation.
Right, gains and losses, and an interesting loss of liberty itself.
Yes, I think I think one of the things which stands out, and which is a theme of the book, is that in this kind of, which is a very British and a very American thing, I think, is the tension between a kind of a Puritan heritage and a love of liberty. That these things can be in constant tension with each other, and that can be a healthy thing. It's out of that sort of conflict that we get our idea of civil society. But what I see is happening is in this pre-Victorian time is the people who are on the side of liberty and social freedoms kind of lost their voice to these self-confident, moralizing social reformers, and the people who tried to stand out against it, like Byron and plenty of other writers and poets, playwrights, and artists who tried to stand up against this kind of growing conformism and growing kind of moral authority in society lost out because they couldn't develop a strain of their own morality, that they just ended up lapsing into silence or lapsing into profanities rather than engaging and taking on these things and trying to shape a combination of all the elements, the Puritan elements and the sort of the free living libertarian kind of thing, that these things could have been combined better, but one side got the running and kind of and took it and sort of dominated that kind of the public morality for a long time.
You know, it's fascinating. As I listen to you, almost every phrase so resonant in our American context right now. There's a lot to latch on to here, and a lot of listeners who want to join us. Ben Wilson, please stand by. Let me get a quick call from George in Newton, Massachusetts. George, what do you hear? What do you think?
Hi, Tom. I have a, my story is that I asked a girl out on a date and didn't say anything indecent to her. She didn't even claim I said anything.
A girl or a colleague? Is this at work or what's the setting?
A girl, I'd rather not talk about the nature of my work, but she didn't work for my company.
Okay.
She worked for a company we do business with.
But in the working world, you ask a girl out on a date and what happened?
And she said it was sexual harassment, and I am not dealing with them at that outfit anymore, and I have a nasty letter in my file, and if I do anything else wrong, I'll get fired. And that's actually, to your point, Tom, to your question, that's, our society is becoming more restrictive, and that's not even coming from the conservatives. The conservatives generally are not in, if you're going to talk in generalizations, conservatives are not where sexual harassment laws come from. They're generally not even in favor of them. That's liberal sexual repression going on.
Right, so there's political correctness or moralism or uprightness of all kinds at work here, George.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll take my response from your listener off the air, but I guess my question is, for those of us who are not in favor of this sort of, and it's peculiar because the media has these very lurid images, which are not largely where people are coming from, but I think that they provide some peculiar preconceptions.
We're talking this hour about the moral majority of yesteryear. Historian Ben Wilson joins us from London. His new book is The Making of Victorian Values. Jerry Falwell, of course, dead this week at 73. He often railed against what he saw as immorality in much the same way as evangelicals railed against sin in the pre-Victorian era. Here's Jerry Falwell on NPR in the weeks leading up to the 2004 presidential election, describing family and marriage as the bedrock of a moral society.
For Christians who take the Bible seriously, most African-American pastors and a great number of evangelical pastors, the issue is simply this. The family is one man married to one woman, period. And to say, as the two candidates are saying, one, Mr. Bush is saying, I'm for the federal marriage amendment, we say, great. Mr. Kerry says, I'm against same-sex marriage, but I'm against a federal marriage amendment. That's like saying 150 years ago, I'm opposed to slavery, but if my neighbor wants to own one, that's all right.
Jerry Falwell, 2004, the voice, the founder of the American Moral Majority. Ben Wilson, there it is, and it's been allied with conservative politics, Republican Party politics in our country. But you heard our caller saying the political complexion of this kind of urge to assert moral authority in a society has more than one political coloring. Was that true in the Victorian era as well, or was it straight up, Wilberforce and the evangelicals?
It comes from both sides. It's associated a lot with Wilberforce, who was certainly conservative, but also this kind of great desire for respectability, desire to be more decent, comes from a rising middle class, which is trying to claim political power from the aristocracy and the old elites. It certainly covers both spectrums in British politics for very different reasons. I think that the old Tories were more allied with, on one side, some of them were more allied with evangelicals and a desire to look out for the poor and try and make the poor reform themselves. And on the Whigs, we're sort of sold on these ideas of political economics and controlling people for sort of economic reasons. But they've got similar roots, but differences. And I think the Call of George showed that, you know, these things do have very complex backgrounds and aren't necessarily applied to one side. It's I think it's something common in all of us is try and search for absolute rules, or to try and sort of make sense of a chaotic life, to try and have some rules that lead us, guide us. And they obviously sometimes go very badly wrong.
Here we are, cultural cousins across the Atlantic. Tony Blair sleeping in the Queen's bedroom in the White House on his way out there. When you, as a British historian, hear the contemporary or fairly contemporary voices there of Newt Gingrich and Jerry Falwell, what do you think about how the United States now relates to rather explicitly or you know thematically to Victorian values and the way the UK does today?
I think it's something we hear quite often, I think, on both sides of the Atlantic, is a desire for some sort of stability, some kind of moral absolutes to guide us. Margaret Thatcher was kind of brought up in this kind of Methodist background, which was kind of instrumental in the kind of the making of these Victorian values. And they lived as the idea of self-reliance and on the relief for the poor being only for the deserving poor. All these phrases are sort of resonant of the 19th century and have deep roots in that heritage. And her economic policies and her social policies try to revive these old ideas. And I think it speaks to, you know, our age as a kind of what was happening in this area is going towards kind of an idea of pure laissez-faire and individualism, and trying to find a kind of a set of values and manners that kind of doesn't stop it breaking down into complete sort of libertarian chaos. I think it's that's the kind of the aspiration of a lot of politicians is to get the best of both worlds as they perceive it.
Try to, anyway. Let's take a call. Christopher in Manchester, Massachusetts. Christopher, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I thought there might be an interesting parallel in the whole question of how the whole moral reform effort could be employed for political ends in the case of the Duke of Cumberland, who was really terribly slandered for political interest by the Whig activists of the early 19th century, in a way that he might well have been now if he existed now.
Ben, can you fill the story in for us? The Duke of Cumberland, does he fit into your tale?
He's a bit earlier, but it's true of all the royalty at this time and higher aristocracy become their sex lives becomes a sort of a good way for, as you say, Christopher, the radicals and Whigs to attack the royal family.
Oh, give us the details. What happened here?
I've completely forgotten.
Christopher,
if
you've got it, what is it, Christopher?
Well, the Duke of Cumberland was the fifth son of King George III, and he has had fairly reactionary Tory politics that he was very keen to defend, and he was a very effective spokesperson for the Tory party. And the Whigs, in order to combat his effectiveness and his position as a member of the royal family, slandered his personal behavior, which was very much more of the outspoken, old-fashioned Georgian variety.
On the sexual front or otherwise?
Sexual front, they made up all sorts of stories about him and used any sort of means to slander his personal private behavior, either related to some degree of truth or just made up entirely. But the process of moral reform, it seems to me, could be used then as now for political purposes.
Creates a lot of opportunity to bring the great low.
Yes.
Yeah, we see that in that tale and many others described here. Let me go to Watertown, Massachusetts, and Michael. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi. To put some context, as far back as the story of King Oedipus, people have been willing to blame things like plagues and famines on immoral behavior. It's a sort of magical thinking that we can't seem to quit, and I think it's very strong in the Muslim world now, where you've got religious fanatics there saying that their societies have declined because people haven't been religiously fanatic enough. I'd also be interested, though, in the historian's take on a question that during the Victorian era, the people at the forefront of the new morality were from the dissenting churches, and they were also the rising industrial class, whereas I'm in high tech, and I don't think there's a segment of society which is less sympathetic with the moral majority than the people driving the economy today.
That's interesting. Ben Wilson, what do you say?
I think that's true. There's sort of kind of the center of this of British moral reform wasn't London. It was the emerging industrial cities, and it played into an economic idea at the time, which was it's a cynical thing to say, but it did play into ideas of controlling the workforce, having respect in society. To have a disciplined workforce that was sort of bought into progressive economic ideas of self-reliance and economy.
But that was in a time when the UK needed masses of workers to march into factories and take their post. We've got a high-tech listener who says, you know, maybe industry pushes in a different direction today. Maybe it's a time when creativity is most prized. Does that align its interests differently?
Does it align its interests differently? I guess there's quite a lot of money to be made out of immorality, in a way, is there not?
Or free thinking, certainly. Creativity, certainly today.
What is the question? I'm not sure what the question is.
I guess in the Victorian age, maybe industry lined up pretty well with this buttoned up, tightened up mores because it got people marching to the new industrial revolution. Masses just putting their shoulders to the machinery. You've got a little less linear, mechanical, mass-driven economy now.
Yeah, and you need that kind of creativity and spontaneity, I think, which is different from economic relations in the Victorian age,
which may complicate the economic piece push of this time compared to that. Let's go to Salem, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on the air.
Yeah, or marching into the Crimean War, I just can't help but be struck by the parallels between the personal and official morality of the Victorians and Bush's compassionate conservatism, both happening at a time of criminal imperialism and in both nations and exploitation of countries and also the British populations at a personal level. Gladstone trolling the streets to reform prostitutes. Gingrich, I can't mention him seriously. A movie that I think everybody should see that was recently shown significantly on Turner Classic Movies is Tony Richardson's Charge of the Light Brigade. Says it all for me. But I think the parallels are, it's interesting, these moralities come along at a time of rampant imperialism and, preemptive wars on the part of the nations who are able to control both the morality and the imperialism. And I'm just wondering how these things were sold to the public and why we fall for them.
Ben Wilson, you sort of your country defined imperialism for the modern age in that century. How did the rise of these Victorian values factor into the imperial impulse? Fact.
Quite well, I think. I'm not an expert on, but certainly the way that the British behaved in India parallels the way things were changing in Britain. That. Before, in the late 18th century and early 19th century, British imperialists in India would marry Indian women, would dress in a style, would live their lives as a kind of admiration for the people that they were colonizing. By about the 1820s, 1830s, exactly the time that things are changing in Britain, there's a much harder line taken towards the colonial populations in places like India, and this sort of quite harmonious thing breaks down, and there's a much much greater sense of a ruling caste, and a sense that a kind of idea of evolution that people, whether they're successful at home and have become successes and become more moral, and that they've got a right to kind of dictate to a kind of benighted lower class who's living in sloth and immorality. The same thing happens in Britain's relationship with the rest of the world, and that's the thing that lots of historians have remarked upon, this the similarities between Britain's sort of internal relations and Britain's relations with the rest of the world. Mm. And there's kind of, you know, these things are accompanied by an idea of a sense of mission, of taking on the world, having this kind of moral capital that's built up at home to take to the rest of the world.
Of course, the caller points at the potential hypocrisy there at the same time. Newt Gingrich, we heard, going on about the Victorian age. And then, of course, you know, he's stepping out sexually. It emerges himself at the very same time. Byron described the 19th century as the age of Kent. And you make a lot of this word, C-A-N-T, one we almost never use anymore or hear anymore, at least in this country. Why did that word, that concept, play such an important role in the debate over this era?
Well, it's like what I was saying earlier about this idea of hypocrisy and how that changes. Kant means talking in an insincere way, of kind of repeating stock phrases that you've learnt by rote but don't really believe in. It's kind of society's clichés that get sort of trapped in the mind and have sort of repeated ad nauseum as a kind of, often not sort of insincerely but unthinkingly, that you to take on... take on the sort of the background chatter that's going on and kind of repeat them yourself. So it's connected to this changing idea of hypocrisy. Byron and lots of other people call it the age of Kant because they see people as being, becoming unable to think for themselves and to develop their own morality and just using stock phrases and stock theories to shield their own vices behind.
He and others describing or fearing a kind of moral illness behind all the talk of morality. Quoting you here, the British were becoming censorious and small-minded, vindictively pursuing people for petty things while letting more serious crimes go unmentioned and unpunished. The lies that society told itself in the jargon repeated while people scarcely noticed hypocrisy and injustice.
Mm, fair. People went after the small things or went after emblematic things whilst... people became poor, whilst rich people, even middle class people, had more mistresses and used prostitutes more. That society wasn't getting better in a lot of ways. It was just they were getting better at concealing it, like they were better at sort of concealing hard words and hard phrases behind cant and cliches. That all this was a kind of a way of masking other injustices in society and other things that. That weren't going so well. It became a way of talking about morality in a public way that had no effect in real life. And I think that's a sort of a common thing these days, isn't it?
Yeah, we've just got a minute here. Americans look over obviously with a sort of mixed view of the Victorian age. What about the British today? Is there a consensus? I don't know. In your class, in your set, how do people look back on it?
I think people look back on it for reassurance because it is a time of consensus and strength. And you find politicians like Margaret Thatcher talking about Victorian values. I think you'd be hard pressed these days to hear a British politician actually talk about Victorian values because it kind of plays both ways. There is an idea that this was a hypocritical age and it was a cruel and exploitative age, and that behind every stern, moral Victorian gentleman was a man full of vice and rather bizarre and exotic love life. So I think since Thatcher, British people have been afraid of talking about morality in terms of Victorianism because it provoked such a strong reaction against it. But that's not to say that there's a growing concern about morality and virtues, and today it's called respect, and it's kind of a war against antisocial behaviour, which is redolent of this time.
Mm. No simple reading of history, as there's no simple reading of life, but it's a fascinating history and we're very grateful for it. Ben Wilson's new history is The Making of Victorian Values, Decency and Dissent in Britain, 1789 to 1837. Ben Wilson in London, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.